You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. We hear about surrogacy routinely in the media, almost consistently in a celebratory way. A baby is gifted to a loving and deserving family, a happy home. But what's really behind the practice, and is it worth celebrating? Why do we speak about something so clearly exploitative and harmful to women as though it's not? Renata Klein is an academic, a biologist, an author, a feminist health activist, and an original signatory to Stop Surrogacy Now. She co-founded Spinifex Press with Dr. Susan Hawthorne in 1991 and published Surrogacy, a Human Rights Violation in 2017. I spoke with her over the phone from her home in Australia. Here's that interview.
You know, you've been doing this work for a long time. Maybe you can just tell me a bit about your background in reproductive health and how you sort of got involved in this issue of surrogacy, or, you know, criticizing and pushing back against the surrogacy industry, you might say.
Yes, with pleasure. Hi, Megan. Nice to be with you. I actually am from Switzerland originally, where I trained as a biologist and then worked in neurobiology for quite a few years. And then I got fed up, not so much with the work, which was very interesting, but with the people, because I couldn't really stand all the arrogance of these people, mostly men. And I thought, oh, I have to do something different with my life. I was in my mid-30s then. And so luck would have it that I went to California and went to the women's studies coordinator at Berkeley University and said, hey, I'm a biologist. Can I do something for the women's studies program? I mean, I barely knew what women's studies was. And she said, yes. Oh, wonderful. You're a biologist. Yes, you can teach biology. And that was the beginning of the end. So I taught in her course, and then I realized how little I knew about social sciences and humanities. So I actually studied women's studies and got a degree, a BA in women's studies with honors from Berkeley, which I really treasure. Then I went on, did my PhD in London in the sociology of education. So I'm both a biologist and a sociologist by training, which is very good when you have to talk to doctors in reproductive technologies who try to put you down. Well, they can't really do that with me that much because I've got the natural science background. But whilst I was doing my PhD, somebody said, what do you think about test your babies? At a party it was, and I said, I don't know what I think. I haven't even thought about this. This was about 1981. And she said, but you should do something about this. You're a biologist. And as things sometimes, you know, it gets into your brain. And so I talked to a couple of friends in the US who were both also scientists. And we decided to do a book on the issue. And it was really the first international feminist book, Test Tube Women, What Future for Motherhood, which was published in 1984, and then immediately published or translated into German. And when we started the project, the three of us, it was Rita, Aditi, Shelley Minden and me, we didn't really have an opinion on whether this was good or bad or indifferent for women. But by the time we finished this book, we absolutely knew this was a very, very dangerous undertaking, the IVF and other reproductive technologies. And then from there on, you know, my life unfolded quite differently. We founded FinRage, which is Feminist International Network of Resistance to Reproductive and Genetic Engineering, that really took off and at its peak, which is sort of like end of the 80s, had over thousands of members in so many countries, and we had lots of conferences. And then I went to Australia in 86 because I got a fellowship to study women who went through IVF. which was just heartbreaking. And so, you know, fast forward to surrogacy, somebody says, oh, you don't understand the heartbreak that infertility produces and these people that just really want this baby. I do know what it means. I do know how really devastating it can be, but that is no reason to exploit another woman or two women if an egg donor is needed. So anyway, then I was professor of women's studies at Deakin University, and we always really taught a lot about reproductive and genetic engineering in master's and grad diploma courses. Then eventually, when all the bad winds came, you know, we got a very bad dean who didn't like the idea of feminism at all, and then sort of changed our women's studies program, eventually moved it to gender studies, and eventually I resigned. Well, no, I didn't resign, I retired. And so, but I still kept working, obviously, with my huge international network on these reproductive technologies. And then at the beginning of the 2000s, surrogacy became really very, very important again, especially when India had such a big traffic in surrogacy. And I thought, I just have to do something. I really, really have to produce another book on this topic. And so I did. And it's Surrogacy, a Human Rights Violation, which I think you have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is the definition of surrogacy? You know, I'm sort of assuming that a lot of people actually don't know very much about surrogacy and really don't know much about this issue at all.
Yes, that's a good question. And you really have to go to the roots exactly and have to ask, what is it? And if you look at it really in the cold, hard light of the day, what it is, it's a woman's body, and she is called sometimes the gestational surrogate, but she's actually a woman who, out of the kindness of her heart or because she needs money, has agreed to have an embryo implanted into her womb. This embryo these days has not got any genetic connection to her. The egg is from either the so-called intended parents, the wife, or if she is too old to have good eggs, as they say, then there's a mostly anonymous egg donor. The sperm most often comes from the husband, or in the case of two gay men, and they are really more and more becoming a terribly important group of people who access surrogacy. It's the men can only produce sperm, as we know. So one of the men produces the sperm, or sometimes they mix them, and then they always need an egg donor. And so this embryo then gets put into this woman, who then gestates this baby. In other words, she grows this baby in her tummy for 9 months, during which time a lot of horrible things can happen. Then mostly it is taken out, the baby is taken out with a cesarean. Often she doesn't get to see it, and it gets immediately taken away by the intended parents. I call them baby buyers, actually. And in many cases, she never gets to see that baby again. So it's fraud, if you think about it. It's a total exploitation of a woman's body and her mind and her soul. Women are just used as breeders. As Julie Bindle has recently called them, vending machines, which is a very good term. I think it's an outrage. It can never, ever, ever be justified, no matter how desperately, infertile people would like to have a baby with at least some of their own genes in it. It can never, ever be justified to exploit the body of a woman who may really suffer a great deal of harm, psychological harm, but also really bodily harm, physiological harm.
Right. And, you know, so it seems to me as though surrogacy happens differently now than it did in the past. You know, people will talk about traditional versus, you said this earlier, gestational surrogacy. So what's the difference there? What's happening now?
Maybe you remember the famous Baby M case and Phyllis Chester, who is still involved today, luckily. She wrote a book on the Baby M case. And in that case, the so-called surrogate mother, and of course that's a misnomer, you know, I call her birth mother, she used her own eggs and she was artificially inseminated with the sperm from the, you know, baby buyers. That man's name was Stern. He was a doctor. She was a doctor. So they came from really, you know, good, healthy, sorry, wealthy backgrounds. Whereas Mary Beth Whitehouse, who was the birth mother, was very poor. Her husband was a janitor. They had no money. And she clearly, you know, did do it for the money. But she then regretted it. She ran away with her child. It got taken from her again in Florida. The police came and got it. And eventually it ended in court. And the court judge, whose name was Sorkoff, declared that the mother, Mary Beth Whitehouse, whose genetics were in the baby, had no right to it because she was poor and the child would have a much better upbringing with the Sterns. She could go to college. And that was that. And there was a lot of feminist action against it. So there was for a while a coalition of feminists against surrogacy. Phyllis Chesler was involved. Janice Raymond was involved. Jenna Correa, who of course, wrote that fabulous book, The Mother Machine, in 1985, who is still an important classic text, and who actually relied, I mean, if you really should say that, on Andrea Dworkin, who in Right Wing Women in 1983 for the first time talked about reproductive brothels. And then Jenna expanded on it, and Jenna in 85 in The Mother Machine predicted that there would be times when surrogates would be held in so-called stables, I think she called it, in poor countries and would carry to terms baby for rich people. And that happened exactly in India, in China, in Nepal, in Cambodia. Luckily, all these countries have now closed their doors to foreigners, at least.
So women were literally being kept in stables and being made to give birth for wealthy people in these countries.
Yes, it really has been happening ever since the 1980s, but it didn't really become very prominent until the beginning of the 2000s. And there are thousands of IVF programs in India. India has a very highly technologically developed side to it, lots of clinics and IVF clinics. And so, of course, they thought, well, we should get into surrogacy as well. And they had heaps and heaps of international people come to them, like a lot of couples from Australia, from the US. It was not so much, it was very much heterosexual couples at first. The gay couples gradually got added. And these women, who were all really poor women, and for them, you know, getting $5,000 at the end was like fantastic. But unfortunately, soon it was found out that their husbands then thought that was a great income stream, and they bought themselves, you know, houses and boats and used it for gambling, and then told their wife that she had to do it again. Whereas if you ask the surrogate mothers why they would do such a thing that harmed their bodies, they all said, well, it's for the education of my children. And so for the duration of the pregnancy, they lived in so-called surrogate houses. So they were so they couldn't really be around their own families, because also it was a stigma. If you did surrogacy, you didn't want your neighbor really to know that, you know, you were a surrogate. It's a bit like you didn't want them to know you were a prostitute. And many women said, well, we need money, and so, you know, I'm either a surrogate or a prostitute. And that was really, really badly exploited by the IVF surrogate industry. They're the same, because you always need IVF for surrogacy. And so there were horrendous stories that have been talked about. And there's a woman, an Indian woman, who's written about this. Her name is Sheila Saravanan. And she has done some fantastic research on it. And a book that we published after my own book last year, which is called Broken Bonds, Surrogate Mothers Speak Out, has a contribution by her in it, where she talks about the incredible, harms to the women, the sadness when they had to give the baby away, but no way could they keep a white baby. Because, of course, because the embryo was made from a white, mostly white couple. So, you know, the resulting baby that was cut out of her womb was white. So no way could she pretend this was a child of her own. But it was still incredibly sad for many to see this baby go and not knowing where it will go to. And very, very few, I would say less than under 1% of people who had a baby in India and then took it away would still be in touch with their surrogates. Very, very few.
So what is it I think the comparison between prostitution and surrogacy is apt, both in terms of what you said around the men taking this money and spending it on themselves and then pressuring these women to go back and do it again. You know, it sounds to me a lot like the pimp prostitute relationship.
Yes.
Are there more connections that you can make? I mean, what's the connection between surrogacy and trafficking, for example?
Surrogacy and trafficking, well, yes. I mean, that in some cases, the surrogates were, from India, for instance, were not left in India. They were then trafficked either back to the rich people into a Western countries. And the reason for that was that they could have a close look at when she was going through her pregnancy and she could be monitored so that she wouldn't eat anything bad or drink anything bad or whatever. Or she was trafficked. For instance, a lot of Indian women were trafficked into Nepal when it looked like, when the government clamped down in originally already 2015 to close the country to foreigners. And so what they did, the clinics, they just moved their surrogates to Nepal, as one does, and continued their evil trade there. Then, unfortunately, you may remember there was a really bad earthquake and there was horrible stories. They had a lot of clients from Israel and they chartered an airplane, came and in cases where the babies had already been born, just took the babies and left the birth mothers behind in the rubble. They could fend for themselves. Or if the baby hadn't been born, then they would have taken the pregnant mother, but immediately, you know, sent her back once the baby was there. It really is really using women as machines, as breeders, as commodities, and the babies as well. I think what's good about my book is that, yes, I talk about all the incredible harm to women that can happen in these surrogate pregnancies. For instance, every time an embryo is used in a pregnancy that is not from the woman herself, so that's also in IVF pregnancies where a donor egg is used, it creates much higher chance of health complications during the pregnancy. And of course, people don't know that. And very often the surrogates don't really know that. So it's totally exploitative, harmful for the women. Many have really long-lasting PTSD, depending on how bad it was, whether they had to have embryo reductions or even abortions in between, whether they had miscarriages, because, of course, it doesn't work all that well. So they had to repeat the process. But you also need to think about the child. So these children, you know, are produced like commodities. And I actually said, you know, has the child ever agreed to be a takeaway baby? Because that's what it is. And in some more horrible, horrible legislations, like, for instance, in Oregon, it's like that. And now that new awful bill that was snuck in the middle of the night because it was attached to a budget bill in the middle of the pandemic, coronavirus, in New York, which is just such a travesty. Anyway, in that bill and in Oregon, before the baby is already born, there's already an agreement between the baby buyers and the surrogate mother, or her lawyers, better. And the baby is already passed on with the names of the baby buyers as the parents. So not only is the woman and her body and her mind and her soul exploited, but she's erased. She's totally erased. She's invisibilized, erased. Her baby, unless the parents actually tell her or him where, who had given birth to her, who had actually grown her, who had made her in her tummy, she will never know. She will just think, if it's a heterosexual couple, that she's their child, which is just the most horrible thing, because we have learned a lot from people who were born from donor conception, you know, either with a neck donor or a sperm donor. And until recently, and I think in the States it still goes on, that these donations are anonymous. And there's now a good international group of donor people, donor children, but they're now adults, some of them. And they really want to have anonymous sperm and egg donations stopped, so that these children and adults now can actually find out their biological heritage, which, you know, is important for many ways. They find out they have siblings in the case of sperm donors. They find out in some cases that they have 20, 30 half brothers and sisters. But it's also important that you know your genetic history in case, you know, you come down with something. So we have all of that. And yet, surrogacy just continues, you know, with anonymous sperm and egg donation.
What is the process for the woman? So what exactly are these women going through who are so-called surrogates?
All right. So a woman agrees to carry a baby for a couple that she mostly doesn't know, or when it's a so-called altruistic surrogacy, she agrees to do this for her siblings or her friends or her whatever cousins, and then off she goes to the IVF clinic, where the egg that either the woman who wants to become the mother, the social mother, has already had extracted from her body, or it comes from an egg donor. The egg and then the sperm from the husband or whatever, from the man, they are made into an embryo, and this embryo is then placed into her body. But before that can happen, her body has to be ready. It has to be ready for this pregnancy, because if she were to get normally, naturally pregnant, you know, her body would have to reach a certain stage where the lining of the uterus would have to be thickened. And so there's already a lot of drugs that get injected into her body, and none of which are good. And one of them is actually the very famous or infamous Lupron, that's now also used in stopping the puberty in so-called, in children that are so-called trans, a very diabolical drug that leads to bone thinning and has other, you know, adverse effects. Now, in IVF, that doesn't last as long as in the transgendering of children, but nevertheless, it is a bad drug. It puts a woman's body into chemical menopause, and then other drugs are inserted. Are injected that start her again. So then her body is ready for the implantation of this embryo. So let's say it works, the embryo implants, it starts developing. Then from that moment on, the woman, the birth mother, the surrogate mother, is under constant surveillance. So-called intended parents take that very seriously. They ring her every day to find out how healthy she is, what she's eating, what she's reading. Others are not so, you know, closely monitoring. There's endless doctor's appointment to see if this embryo is growing the right way. and then turns into a fetus, and then often more than one embryo was implanted, because often the baby buyers say, oh, they want twins, or even just for the simple reason that if you implant two or three embryos, there's a higher chance that one of them takes, as the expression goes. But sometimes all three take. And then the baby buyers say, oh, no, we don't want triplets. And then the woman has to undergo a so-called fetal reduction. And that's a very horrible procedure, because what happens is that salt is injected into the beating heart of one of the fetuses, and it dies. And you can imagine, like, you know, I support a woman's right to abortion. So even for me, I find that a very horrible idea, that this dead fetus then shrivels away next to her or his brother and sister, if there's two more in there or just one more there, and it eventually gets absorbed. Now, in actually the course, yeah, just to finish this, but for somebody who is pro-life, it must just be absolutely agony to read about of that. The woman herself, you know, the surrogate herself, she may be pro-life, and for her that might be agony. What I've really learned when I was writing my book, which really, in a way, was a bit late in my life, but I started to read up a lot about the actual process of pregnancy. And which normally, you know, like in all my feminist life, yes, women become pregnant, and then for some it's okay, and others need an abortion, and yes, abortion has to be legal and available and as safe as possible, which it never quite is, but still. But I didn't really know about all the intricacies. And when this little embryo and then fetus, you know, when they start perceiving things like sounds and smells and what the mother eats and music even, and it's quite incredible. It's an incredible feat that a woman's body can actually produce produce a human baby from just basically a fertilized egg, and in 9 months there's this huge baby, bingo. And the placenta in particular is an incredible organ that I am sure we'll find out much more. And for instance, it has been found out that during the pregnancy, fetal cells go into the mother's body and stay there often for decades. And some people say that they help a woman when she gets sick, you know, with her illness. I don't know how much of this is really true or not, but it's such an intriguing thought. And the woman's own cells, some of them also go into the baby and stay there. So, you know, sometimes promoters of surrogacy say, oh, this woman has no connection whatsoever to the baby. She's just a breeder, the vessel, a suitcase, an oven. She just bakes the bun, you know, in the oven. All of this has been said. And they totally disregard all these natural things that happen in a pregnancy. And so basically, and then as I said earlier, because the egg in many, many cases has been made by the egg in all cases does not have the woman's genetic makeup in it, and so therefore she's at higher risk for very dangerous conditions such as placenta previa, where towards the end of the pregnancy she gets an awful high blood pressure and she has to be hospitalized, and this has led to this, or eclampsia, and that too she needs to be hospitalized. Many get gestational diabetes, which is also very dangerous. So there are all conditions that when a woman early said, yes, I want to do that for money or for love, they have really no idea what can happen in pregnancy, because that all gets downplayed by the IVF doctor. And the general population really doesn't know about it. And what gets to me sometimes, the media all has happy stories of surrogates, you know, as if there was not a problem. Well, there's lots and lots of problems.
And it is interesting the way the media covers surrogacy, which is that it's sort of this joyful thing, and they always treat it as like a gift, like the surrogate, or almost always, I should say. You know, the surrogate is, you know, glad to be giving this gift to this couple, you know, this woman who can't have a child, or a gay couple, or whatever. And, you know, I don't see coverage of the poor women, you know, the women in India and those kinds of places, where they really don't have a choice. I mean, I did want to talk about this question of choice with you also, and I know you've written about this a bunch, because, you know, I think, you know, maybe people
maybe if I can just go about the media. I mean, that was one of the reasons why we produced this book, Broken Bonds. You know, it's got, I think, 17 stories in by surrogate mothers and also egg donors. To really show that, no, actually, you know, there's an awful lot of misery and harm and tears and sadness going on, which we don't hear in the glossy medias. But I think we also, because, yes, on the one hand, you know, there's laws, and as soon as you don't really go to the bottom, to the roots, as a good radical feminist, of course, I do that. And that's why, you know, I see it as exploitation and harm and never be okay. But if you don't do that, you come into very dangerous realms of regulations. And as soon as you are into regulations, you, I think, have lost the game, because regulations just means, and this just happened in the New York State bill, you put a little bit of more better security in there for the surrogate mother, and a bit more of this and a bit more of that. But it ignores the very fact that at the very bottom, as we said at the beginning, surrogacy is a total violation of another woman's body. And whether she agrees or not is really, in a way, quite doesn't even matter. It's like the Palermo Protocol for trafficked women. Consent doesn't matter. Even if a woman says, yes, yes, I agree to be trafficked from, you know, a poor country to the US, for instance, it is still trafficking. And that is a UN protocol, and it's the same for surrogacy. Now, I think we really have to also start looking into the whole notion, and it's not new, we have looked into it, but we just need to look into it more and more, the whole notion of that it seems to be the most wonderful things for a woman that she can do with her life is to give and to sacrifice and to be altruistic and to be nice and kind and donating. And that is, I mean, you always hear surrogate mothers saying, or egg donors for that matter, I just, it's the best gift of my life that I could do, that I donate these eggs, and I know that some of them would, you know, be used to make a new human beings. There is something really wrong. We need to really draw attention to this fact that it's not okay if a woman is nice and kind and caring and nurturing and loving and has empathy at the expense of her own health, mental and physical health, which is exactly what happens in surrogacy. And that's why the problem with, for instance, the legislation in New York was that because New York allows altruistic surrogacy, which supposedly no money changes place, which is not really right, because birth mothers can be paid back, have to be paid back for expenses during the pregnancy, but there is not a fixed sum that gets, that changes hands. And because that already exists in New York State, a lot of the critics and a lot of people lobbying the government and say don't make commercial surrogacy legal in New York, they couldn't really go and attack surrogacy per se, because it was felt it was too difficult to also attack surrogacy, because altruistic surrogacy was already legal. And so it was this, they did an awful lot of good work. And when I say they, so it was the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women. It was, of course, Stop Surrogacy Now, with the very wonderful Jennifer Lull at the helm. She was just so instrumental because she made it possible that surrogate mothers could travel to New York, except then when the pandemic hit, you know, everything was closed down. They couldn't even give their testimony. So the assembly people who voted for this bill really, I think, really didn't have enough information. And Andrew Cuomo, the governor, who I believe is getting quite a lot of praise for how he handles the coronavirus pandemic, but he was really pushing for it because he really wants to do well by the IVF industry and also by gay men. Because he lost them, and he also always brought Andy Cohen and some of the other celebrities in. And so the radical feminists who were really opposing this bill couldn't go to the root. They just had to kind of, some actually did say, oh, well, altruistic surrogacy is okay, but it is not okay. In the end, to me, it doesn't actually matter whether you pay for the baby or you don't. It is still not okay. It is still using women as an incubator, and that should never be allowed. And also in the book Broken Bonds, we have a few stories by women who were altruistic surrogates and two stories from Australia. And quite frankly, it is so heartbreaking to listen to those stories or read those stories that in some ways I think altruistic surrogacy is possibly even worse than commercial surrogacy because hearts get broken, families get split. In a commercial surrogacy, the birth mother or gestational surrogate, I don't think thinks she's going to be best friends with the baby buyer's mother. Baby buyer's woman, the wife. But in altruistic surrogacy, in the case of Odette that writes in Broken Bones, she did it for her cousin. She loved her cousin. Her cousin couldn't have babies because she'd become medically infertile through cancer treatments. So Odette just thought, yeah, sure, I'll do it for you. I love you. I'll do anything for you. And it went so totally, absolutely, horribly, horribly wrong. It split the family. They're not talking to each other anymore. Odette, despite the fact that she is the mother on the birth certificate in Australia, she has not been able to see her child for, it's now 4 years old. It's a really horrible situation. She misses her little son every day, and the pain is even bigger and more heartbreaking than in commercial surrogacy, I think.
Hmm. I mean, there's so much about this that is connected to, you know, traditional sexist ideas of what a woman should be. I mean, the idea that women are supposed to be so compassionate and so giving that they give up their own well-being and health and mental health for other people. But also, you know, how much of this is connected to, how much of this industry and this practice is connected to the idea that a woman is worthless if she can't give birth. Yes. You know, if she waits too long to give birth, that, you know, she's no worth or purpose in the world if she chooses not to, that, you know, if she doesn't give birth, she's worthless to society.
Yes, absolutely. That's really an important point. A woman is still not seen a proper woman if she doesn't have her child. I mean, there was time in the 80s, 90s when we actually started to talk about child-free women, you know, women who had actually really chosen, and I use this word here, choice, which normally I don't use, but they had made a deliberate decision to not have children. And but that discourse, that, you know, it's really not, it's gone away. It's not being talked about. And my favorite anecdote, which is actually really true, is a 30-plus-year-old woman goes home to her parents on the weekend and says, "Oh, I've got great news." And her mother looks at her and says, "Oh, you're pregnant." And she said, "No, I'm finished my PhD." And the woman, the mother says, "Oh, okay. Oh, congratulations." And that is still the case. And we, you know, have to keep on saying that women who decide not to have children can have a perfectly wonderful life without having their own biological children, and men too, for that matter. And that doesn't mean they can't have children in their life. They can look after children, they become teachers. There's so many different ways of looking after children in their lives. But it goes very often to the man wanting his biological, you know, heritage in the child. I mean, even in 1986, when I did this study of women going through IVF, many of the women would have been quite happy to foster children or adopt children, which is not problematic, actually, but their husbands didn't want to do that. They wanted their own flesh and blood, despite the fact it's only half their flesh and blood, because the other half, the egg, is always coming from an egg donor. But never mind. Aristotle said already that the sperm was what made, you know, a human being, and we don't seem to have moved very much from that idea. So yes, I mean, you can actually construe the idea that really surrogacy, in a way, is also showing men's dominion of women by basically forcing, you know, women to have, well, forcing or buying, paying women to have a baby so that their precious genetic heritage lives on. That should be really talked about more. But I think also, you know, we talk about how can we stop this industry or at least reduce it. And again, making the analogy to prostitution. And I mean, I do call surrogacy reproductive prostitution because I truly think it is. Like if you look at Sweden and other countries that have the Nordic laws where the prostitution buyers are criminalized and women are helped out of prostitution. Now, if you make a similar argument with surrogacy, we just have to keep on saying that going and hiring a surrogate is deeply unethical. It's a violation of a woman's human right, and it should never happen. And we could do it in Sweden because apparently young men now think that only really, you know, sort of old fuddy-duddies who haven't seen the light still go and see prostituted women, and they, young woke blokes, wouldn't do that. And we have to somehow move the discourse in surrogacy to that level, which is unfortunately very, very far from where we are, because at the moment the group that is driving the surrogacy industry are really gay men. And often heterosexual people feel really very embarrassed or to speak out against that because they say, "Oh, I don't want to be seen homophobic." Luckily, I've been a lesbian for, I don't know, 40 plus years, so I can speak out. I don't think it's homophobic to criticize gay men for wanting to use a woman as a breeder. Actually, it doesn't matter whether they're gay men or heterosexual men, whether they're single men or single women, rare, or whatever. It is not on to do that. But in the case of gay men, you know, we've seen this phenomenon of first, gay people can now marry, and good on who wants to get married. I mean, I never joined the women's liberation movement to get married, but that's another discussion. But if they want to do that, we know why they're doing it. They want to be accepted by their families. And for some families, that is a degree of recognition that, you know, their offspring and his partner or her partner, they're okay, they're normal because now they can get married. But then for gay men, so they got the big wedding party, they got the big wedding cake, they got, you know, whatever. Now what comes next? The baby. It is really, it's kind of just, we're mimicking heterosexuality, becoming more heterosexual than heterosexuals, because many heterosexual couples actually decide not to have children. But it's increasing, it's like social contagion that, okay, two gay men, you got married, you have a considerable income because you're two men, so you earn more than women mostly, which is not to say that all gay men are rich, but many are. So now what comes next? The baby or babies. So you can match them. Often they want twins, then they match them, you know, like a boy. You can select the sex when you before you implant the embryo. So there's a boy embryo and a girl embryo. And so then two gay men have got a girl and a boy. And they've been TV programs made on this in Australia. Gay, obviously very rich couple, very proud of their two children. Boy in blue, girl in pink. Luckily, they also had a lot of greyhounds, so I was quite intrigued with all the greyhounds. But, you know, the wealth is just spewing from them. Not to think about their surrogate, that was kind of like, well, you know, we forget about this. Then there's also some incredible woman hatred that some gay men, I really want to stress some gay men, not all gay men, have for women, and some because they can't stand women's bodies, and that has actually been written about. I'm not inventing this. They insist that there is a cesarean because they don't want their precious child to go through the birth canal of a real woman in her vagina. You know, yuck, how yuck can that be? Now, again, let me stress that is probably a very small percentage of gay men. I don't mean to vilify gay men. I mean, they are just as much in the commodification industries as everybody else. You know, so as I said, they maybe have, if they have a lot of wealth, they have the big car, they have the big house, but they even have many wonderful greyhounds. And what's missing? The babies. And nowadays, you know, you can just shop around for babies. Babies have really become commodities. And, you know, in Australia, but I know in Canada as well, in the US, there have been horrible, horrible, sad, outrageous stories of children of Aboriginal women being taken away. And there have been apologies to these stolen generations, as we call it in Australia. And there have also been apologies to single mothers whose babies were taken away, because in the 60s, 70s and 80s, still a single mother was not deemed to be a safe person to have a baby out of wedlock. So the babies were taken away and were adopted. And in 2013, our one and only female Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, actually apologized to these taken away babies that are now, of course, all grown-ups. And said things, and it's in my book, said things like, this will never happen again. We will never take a baby from her mother so she cannot, you know, see it and smell it and touch it. We'll never do that again. Well, we're doing it exactly again with surrogacy, and nobody, or I shouldn't say nobody, very few people are actually seeing it in that light. But, you know, there is resistance. So I mentioned Jennifer Lull before, and she and many others, and Julie Bindle and I and Kaiser Kis Ekman, we were amongst the original signers. In 2015, we started a group called Stop Surrogacy Now, which is, you know, you can subscribe to it, then you get all the wonderful emails with updates. That has a huge impact worldwide. Then there's a group in France called ICAMS, the International Coalition for the Abolition of Surrogate Motherhood. In Australia, we formed last year, we formed APSA, which is the Australian Abolition of Surrogacy. We all use the word abolition, or we try to use the word abolition, and therefore, you know, we are really allies of prostitution abolition. And so we're doing all our best, but it really is a lot a lot about is about consciousness raising. And it's a very, very long way to go. And the world doesn't really want to hear us.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you see any connection or have any concern around a potential connection between surrogacy and eugenics.
Oh, definitely. The connection is absolutely, totally there. Because from the word go, when a woman, well, actually already before the woman gets pregnant, the embryos are often tested. It costs extra money to have an embryo tested to see if it is genetically, you know, normal. And I use quotation mark about around normal. In other words, you can see if it has an extra third 21st chromosome. And if it has, well, then sorry, that embryo doesn't not get implanted. So you don't want a child with Down syndrome. So that gets done in many instances. But if the baby buyers don't want to spend all that money, then they just put their embryos, when they look healthy, in the petri dish. They put that into the woman's body, and then she has to undergo test after test, ultrasound after ultrasound. And the moment something gets seen that may not be 100% perfect, well, the woman can be asked to undergo an abortion. Now, again, as I said before, like, you know, some surrogates may not approve of abortion, but in the contract that they sign, they have to agree to have an abortion if the baby buyers insist on that. So eugenics is a huge factor. I mean, they don't want any disabled children. And there have been some horrible cases, like one famous case from India was where a disabled baby was born, the parents rejected it and just didn't take it. And so eventually that poor baby is now in some orphanage in India, and it is probably forgotten forever. And last year, in fact, it's a very sad case from Ukraine. Ukraine is another country that has become a haven for surrogacy. And an Australian team for a foreign correspondent did a fantastic report on going to Ukraine and looking into surrogacy. And they found this poor little girl. She was about 3, I think, at the time, that quite severely disabled. And she was left behind by her rich American lawyer parents, who simply didn't want her because she was disabled. They actually told the clinic that she should be left to die, and the clinic didn't do that. And this little girl is now living in a nursing home, but if there was a fundraiser attached, and it raised quite a bit of money, and so hopefully she will now get looked after so she can actually keep, you know, living independently, because otherwise she has to go into an old people's nursing home and will not get any physio anymore. So, you know, eugenics, you name it, absolutely. It's one of the cornerstones of surrogacy. You know, only the best should be born.
Mm-hmm. How do we, I mean, it seems like there needs to be a multifaceted approach. Obviously, you're fighting laws, you're fighting the legalization of commercial surrogacy, but then there's also the cultural shift. And as you said, you know, people understanding that it's unethical no matter what. I mean, one of my concerns is, you know, how do we convince people that, A, you don't need a baby. You can have a happy, fulfilling, wonderful life without having a baby of your own. And B, that having a baby is not a right.
Yes, absolutely. That's an important thing. I think I haven't said that yet. There is absolutely no right to a child. There just isn't, for anyone, whether they're, you know, heterosexual, homosexual, single or whatever. There is no right to a child. And so therefore, that in itself should be enough to stop any surrogacy in its tracks, but it doesn't. And yes, exactly. People have to realize that they can live very socially fulfilling and good lives. That doesn't mean that they, you know, often people who don't have children are portrayed as, oh, they just want to travel and they're bad people. They don't have any empathy. It's just rubbish. A lot of people decide they don't want their own biological children, but they still look after other people and help looking after children. It's not just like black or white. You can still have children in your life. That message is just simply not going out enough. It really isn't.
I agree. Thank you so much for your work on this. It's such an important issue, and it's just such a struggle. I mean, it's just, as you're aware, it's not a mainstream conversation by any means. So, you know, and you've been working on this for some time and some other women, but I really hope that we can get this conversation going in a mainstream way so people start to understand how harmful it is.
Yes, that is my wish too. And I have to say again, you know, there are very many prominent radical feminists involved in all of these conversations. I mean, you know, Julie Bindle has done wonderful work on it. Sheila Jeffries has also worked on it, although she says we're going to publish her autobiography later in the year. I've just proofread it, actually. And she says somewhere she's sorry she never really wrote about surrogacy, because, like me, she sees it as reproductive prostitution. And then Jennifer Lyle, Janice Raymond, of course, was an early member of FinRaid. So, and the French women are great. There's also a group of strong women in Spain, because surrogacy is not allowed in Spain. Maybe that's the other thing to say. People don't know that mostly Europe either prohibits all forms of surrogacy, like in France, in Sweden, in Germany, so many other countries, or only allows altruistic surrogacy. Many people think, oh, well, surrogacy just exists everywhere. Well, no, it doesn't. In Australia, for instance, we have altruistic surrogacy, but quite frankly, we don't really have a lot of cases. I mean, the industry would like that to go up, but, well, you know, and I don't think that commercial surrogacy will come in here, although there's always some postmodern academics who, it's always the same, you know, who say, yes, it should be allowed. And it is just really important for people who live in countries like, for instance, the US, who just think, oh, well, it's everywhere, so why shouldn't we have it? In Canada, too, Canada also only has altruistic surrogacy. However, Canada has become quite a destination for Australian tourists to go and buy a baby, because in Canada, apparently, it is really quite simple to manipulate the way that you can pay money to the surrogate mother without it being seen as commercial surrogacy, which is illegal. So that's happening quite, I mean, it is touted on pro-surrogacy websites in Australia that Canada is a good country to go to, which you don't really want that trafficking either.
Well, thank you for all this information. I'm sure it's going to be incredibly enlightening to a lot of people. How can they get involved in this fight if they would like to? You mentioned subscribing to Surrogacy Now, I believe.
Stop Surrogacy Now.
Surrogacy Now, of course.
Not Surrogacy Now.
The opposite.
Stop Surrogacy Now, and it's free, and you can, there's a wonderful, really good declaration there that was initially signed by 500 people, and you know, they can sign on, it costs nothing, and they get updates. If they live in Australia, they can sign on to APSA, ABSA. We have a Facebook, we don't actually have much else. And if they live in France, they can sign up to ICAMS, which everything can be found on the web. So, you know, there are groups that are fighting against it. I really wish we had a proper what's the word for it, a proper document that we can use as our own feminist convention for the abolition of surrogate motherhood. There are attempts, there have been attempts at this, and I quote some of it in my book, but we still need this document that we can all pass around and say, hey, read this, and it can't be too long, but it still has to also quote all the various UN conventions, which clearly say that surrogacy contravenes them. And the French women are actually working on this, and I really hope that we will see it before too long, because that's really important. We can forget the idea that the UN will ever adopt it as a convention of their own. That just won't do it. They have too many liberals that have slowly, you know, gotten into the whole UN organization. So I think that's just a waste of even time, although some women will probably try to do that. But that is another way. We just have to have something that we can get, something easy to read that we can give to people and say, read this. And actually, my book is really not too bad. It's not too long. It's easy to read, but it's still a book. And some people, you know, prefer to read articles. But we have all written articles. It's not that we haven't written. It's a bit like with prostitution. I think we all know that prostitution really should not exist. We've written, published books, articles, done interviews, whatever, and still some men think they have the right to violate a woman's body and stick their penis inside. And really, surrogacy is not that much different. It's not the penis per se, but it's what comes out of this penis, which is the sperm. So at the end of the day, I actually really do think that it is the male sex right who wishes to have the right to procreate their own child, whatever is necessary, and whoever gets exploited in the way of doing so. And a lot of people don't want to hear that, but I think at the bottom of it, that is the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. Thank you again. It was really great to talk with you. I mean, it's a serious topic, but it's also just nice to connect with you in general, and I really appreciate your time and all your excellent work.
Yeah, well, thank you, Megan, for asking. And, of course, I really appreciate your work and all the trials and tribulations that you had to go through. And thank you for surviving and being here and asking the hard questions.
You just heard an interview with Renata Klein, co-founder of Spinifex Press and author of Surrogacy, a Human Rights Violation. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen: iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider making a donation to support our work. We don't have ads. We don't get grants. We don't have corporate funding. We rely entirely on reader and listener donations, so please do help us out. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.